the opposable thumb, walking upright on two legs, and our use of tools were no doubt essential to our success as a species. But the ability to imagine, reflect, reason, and ultimately communicate our innermost thoughts and feelings to one another is perhaps what truly distinguishes humans from the rest of Earth's creatures. And at the core of this communication is storytelling. Stories are how we think. They're how we make meaning of life, writes Dr. Pamela Rutledge, director of the Media Psychology Research Center. Life itself, of course, is a story. And today on KGOU, we add to your own story some of the tales that were told well by several professional storytellers on the inaugural evening of the Arts Council of Oklahoma City's 2013 Oklahoma City Storytelling Festival. The tellers to be featured on this special highlights broadcast include famed Celtic harpist and storyteller Patrick Ball, Judith Black, noted storytelling veteran and founder of Three Apples Storytelling Festival, and Barbara McBride Smith, Oklahoma resident and recipient of the John Henry Falk Award for Outstanding Contributions to Storytelling. We'll begin with Barbara McBride Smith, who, when not touring the country performing, is an adjunct professor at Phillips Theological Seminary in Tulsa, sharing her insights on how to artfully convey Bible stories. Now, I don't know that this particular version of a famous Bible story is on the curriculum, but it is a great beginning.
I moved to Oklahoma 33 years ago, and the first arts event that I ever attended was this festival that summer. Thank you, Lynn Maroney. It hooked me, and I've been hooked ever since. This story is a rendition, my own rendition, of an old story that was retold by an old friend. His name's John Erickson from Texas, West Texas. And he first published this in 1981 in a book called The Devil in Texas. And here's how I tell it. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And God said, let all the waters be gathered together in one place and let the dry land appear. And that land appeared, and it was dry, very dry. And God said, I will call this place Oklahoma. This is good, said God, real good. And then God said to God's self, let us make a man in our own image. And so God made a man, call that man Adam, and gave him a horse and put him in Oklahoma. And then God made a garden up in northeast Oklahoma. And he called it Eden. And in that garden, God put growing things and creeping things and crawling things and things that only God knows what they are. And in that garden, God put plants and trees that were good for food. And then God said to that man, Adam, you may subdue any of the beasts of the field that are in this garden. You may subdue any fowl of the air, any animal in this garden except for the cow. Don't mess with the cow. The cow's a special animal. The cow's also stupid. And then God said, he's going to need some help. I'm going to make him a partner. And so God took a rib from Adam's side and made a woman. And he called her Eve. And he showed that woman to Adam and asked him what he thought. And Adam said, "Yeehaw!" And God said, "This is good. Real good." Now, in that garden, there was another creature. It was called a serpent. And that serpent was real sneaky. And one day, the serpent slipped up to Eve and said, "Why don't you subdue the cow? You know, if you got a hold of that cow real good, you could milk it. And then you would have milk and you would have cream and you could make cheese and you could make butter. Not only that, but that cow, it could provide you with calves and all that stuff is real good eating." And Eve said, "No! No! God said, don't mess with the cow." And the serpent said, "Oh, surely you misunderstood. Now, why would God have given you the cow here in this garden if he didn't want you to mess with it?" Well, this troubled Eve somewhat. And she said, "I don't know, but I'll bring it up with Adam." So she went to Adam and she told him what the serpent had said. And Adam said, "No! No, God said, don't mess with the cow. I tell you what, that serpent is a real snake. But I'll talk to him." And so Adam talked to the serpent. And the serpent said, "If God had not wanted you to mess with the cow, why would he have given you a horse?" And Adam said, "The horse? Well, what's the horse got to do with it?" God looked down at all this, of course, and thought to himself, "This is not good." But the serpent kept it up. The serpent said, "Well, you know, if you got up on that horse's back and you rode it, if you trained that horse, you could make it drive that cow anywhere you want it to go." And Adam said, "Dadgum, I didn't know that." "Well, all right," said Adam. And so Adam leaped upon the horse's back, and behold, that horse erupted and threw Adam into the tree of knowledge. Well, Adam came back to the serpent and he said, "This ain't working. The horse does not want to be trained. He is not cooperating with me." And the serpent said, "Behold, it is written, if a man is thrown from a horse, he must get back up on it before he's frozen with fear." Adam said, "I'm already frozen with fear." But Adam got back up on that horse anyway. And this time, when that horse erupted, Adam hung on. He held on real tight. And that horse bucked and it snorted and it threw its feet around like it had dynamite in its shoes. But Adam hung on. And finally that horse calmed down. Oh, Eve applauded and she cheered because she thought that's what women were supposed to do. But she was real proud of Adam. Well, sure enough, Adam rode that horse over to where the cow was standing, and he began to drive that cow around. He made that cow go everywhere he wanted it to go, all over the garden. But when Adam got down off the horse and tried to milk the cow ran off. So Adam went back to the serpent, and he said, "This ain't working. That cow, I can't catch it so that I can milk it." And the serpent said, "You see that grass over there? Go cut it, weave it, and make a rope." So Adam did what the serpent said, and he came back. He said, "All right, I got a rope. What do I do with it?" And the serpent said, "This ain't good." But he took it, and he showed Adam how to make a loop with it. And then he told Adam how to throw it like a lasso. and how to catch that cow by the horns or the heels. And so Adam climbed back up on the horse, and he took that rope, and he went out, and he lassoed the cow. And then he held it still while Eve ran over and milked the cow. And then they let the cow go. And then Adam drove that cow again all over the garden. And then he let it go, just for fun. And he spent the rest of the day driving that cow all over the garden and then letting it go, having fun. Well, that evening God came walking through the garden. And God called out, "Adam, Eve, where are you?" Now Adam and Eve, they hid themselves in a fig bush because they were embarrassed and ashamed because they knew they had done something they weren't supposed to do. And then God saw the cow. God saw that the cow had a flat udder. She had rope burns on her horns and on her heels. And God said, "My children, what have you done?" And Adam stepped out of the fig bush and he said, "It's my wife. She talked to a snake." And Eve stepped out of the bushes and she said, "He's the one that made the rope." And then together the two of them said, "It was the serpent that made us do it." And so God cursed the serpent. He put poisonous fangs in his mouth. He put a rattle on his tail. And he told that snake he was going to have to crawl on his belly for the rest of his days. And people would be terrified when they saw him. And then God turned to Adam and said, You're going to have to work from now on. I'm going to give you the hardest job in the world. You're going to be a cowboy. You're going to have to work outside in the heat of the Oklahoma summers, in the cold of the Oklahoma winters, and your pay's going to be real low. Not only that, I'm going to give you a plow and you're going to have to grow your own food. And then God turned to Eve and said, "You're going to have to work too. And your work is never going to be done. And if you think Adam's pay is low, wait till you see yours." Oh, not only that, but you, Eve, you're going to bear children. Now, at first, you're going to think this is a blessing. You're going to love and you're going to nurture them and care for them, and then they're going to become adolescents. And lo, for a while, they are going to be stupider than the cow. "And now," said God, "you're going to have to get out of my garden. I am sending you to the ends of the earth. I'm sending you to where the wind comes sweeping down the plain." "No," said Adam and Eve, "not the panhandle." "Yes," said God, "the panhandle. Now get some clothes on and get out of here. But don't forget, you're still my children. I'll be watching and I'll be listening and I'll do what I can to help. Oh, in that place where you're going, out there to the ends of the earth, the panhandle, people are going to say that it's a God-forsaken place. But I haven't forsaken it. I'm going to populate it with the friendliest people on the earth. And after a while, it'll grow on you. Now get." And so Eve took some fig leaves and she made a little dress for herself. She made some chaps for Adam. They got up on the horse and the cow, and they rode out to the panhandle. And when they saw that place, they knew that paradise was indeed lost. But then again, sometimes paradise lost is heaven found.
Barbara McBride-Smith, recorded live during the 2013 Oklahoma City Storytelling Festival. I'm KGOU Program Director Jim Johnson with you on today's very special feature as we present highlights from this most recent Oklahoma City Storytelling Fest. This next artist is well known for relating stories to children, but Judith Black actually helped to start Storytellers in Concert, the first and longest-running storytelling series for adults in America. Today, we feature a personal anecdote that she shared from the stage at the Oklahoma History Center, again during the inaugural evening of the 2013 festival.
It is so good to be here. What a wonderful place. And you can't stop singing your state song, and who else gets a state song by Rodgers and Hammerstein? Come on. I asked Sondheim if he'd do one for Massachusetts, but no go. A few years ago, I was in China with a gaggle of storytellers, and our friends Robert and Nancy, Ethnotech, take a group of people, and we have a village in China that we have an ongoing relationship with. And on the way out, we're in Beijing the night before we leave, and Robert comes pounding on my door. He goes, come on, come on, we're going ballroom dancing at the Forbidden City gates. So what would you do? You'd put on your shoes and you'd go dancing. We were like completely psyched. They close these ancient doors, and every night from 7 to 10, they ballroom dance. Now, ethnically, this part of China are all Han people. And Han people, they do things right. When they dance properly. When they move the way they are taught. They are exquisite, and it is like a sea of beautiful conformity when you see them dancing. Well, then came the Americans. So it was Robert's birthday, and Nancy had bought him these giant glasses with big candles on them, and we purchased a birthday cake that we would share with everybody who was down there. And when we come down, everybody's, one, two, three, one, two. Then we show up, and it is chaos at ballroom dancing. The ancient doors they're sculpted in a way that you'd have to go there to see, thousands of years old. And this huge plaza has kind of two Soviet-style sound speakers, and they still used a record player. And when we arrived, now the only two of us who could dance at all were Robert and Nancy, but they didn't do. They did sort of like a Sid Charisse thing, you know, and Robert would sling her down to the ground and bring her up, and the sweet Han people just started to back up. And they're watching him fling her above his head, and then we do something absolutely unheard of in China. We start freestyle dancing. We're Americans, that's what we do. And then we bring out the cake, we light the candles, we give out cake to everybody. And they were as sweet as they could be. Each one of us were asked to dance by one of the regular attenders of the ballroom dancing. And a very sweet Han woman who came to about here on me invited me to dance. She played the man. And she was so gracious, she did not howl once out of the 342 times I stepped on her foot. And as we danced, she looked at Robert, and these were the only English words or letters she knew. She looked up and said, USA? Yeah, USA. And then she nodded towards Nancy, his wife. USA? Yeah, USA. And then she nodded towards Arif, who was he was helping to make a film of this and is a good friend from Chicago. USA? Yeah, USA. And now, I'm going to tell you the truth. When I travel internationally and people say, where are you from? I sometimes go, Canada. It's just that our international policy as of late does not tend to make friends, and you want it to be a smooth trip. But in this case, what could I say? She pointed to Karen, who looked like Pippi Longstocking. She's from the Midwest with big freckles, and she goes, USA? Yeah, USA. She points to Charlotte, USA? Yes, USA. And then finally, she looks in my face and goes, USA? Yes, USA. And she had this quizzical look that I just didn't understand. 2 days later, we are back in San Francisco. And the husband and I go to a drumming concert. And it's remarkable. There are three different Pan-African groups. And when it's over, we watch all the people pour out and we go, we're back with our people. I mean, there was a 6'3" African-American man with dreadlocks down to here, and he's rapping to a tiny Asian woman. And there are two guys who had to be Cuban because no one else speaks Spanish that fast. And they're drumming the rhythms out on each other's back. And there's this old couple, and they were from Nob Hill, and ancient. He was in a wheelchair, and she had a lovely little white bun, and she's beating the rhythms on his wheelchair. And I'm looking, my people. And I got it. She nodded to Robert. Well, yeah, his parents were from Japan and the Philippines, but they made their way here, and he's USA. Nancy, her people are Han, and she looked like an image of everyone else who was dancing there. But trust me, she is 100% USA. There was Arif. And Arif came from Bangladesh, and his parents made their way here so their children could be educated. And he is now an accountant, an owner of property, a man of means, a comedian, a mensch. And he has deep chocolate skin and a narrow nose and the best sense of humor you'd ever, oh yeah, USA. And then Karen, well, you know, her people came from Northern Europe and they came looking for land and they found it here. And Charlotte, her people came in shackles on the bottom of slave ships. But she's one of the finest storytellers in the country now. And me? Well, the face is like a map of my Jewish people from Lithuania. And they came here running from all sorts of anti-Semitism and pogroms. And they made their life here. Give me your tired, your hungry, your teeming masses. And I thought back and wished I could have said to her, oh yeah, all of us, USA.
Okay, one more quick story about dancing. Once you've got a theme, you know, you want to like keep it rolling here. Dancing. So, this starts, I'm on the phone. Oh my God, I can't believe it. So, he said he would take ballroom dance lessons. It took me 6 years, 2 months, 3 days and 7 hours to talk my husband into doing it. Where are you going? Fred Astaire Studios, where is that? Oh, come on. Listen, we are taking at the Marblehead YMCA. It is around the corner. He'd feel so much better if friends took with us. What are they charging? Oh, it's one-third that. Please, please talk. See if you wouldn't come to the Y. Friends would come. Now, I have to tell you, my husband was about as excited. Well, actually, he thought that taking ballroom dance classes would leave him looking like a frog that lives downstream from the industrial chicken farm. Some of you get this, some of you don't. But there is so much estrogen that goes into the water, they kind of lose their male characteristics. You know, and he was like, eh. But when he heard our friends were taking it, he relaxed a little. So the first night at the YMCA, now, this is our old YMCA. I might live in a blue state, but our YMCA in my town is red. And the good, hard-working Republican journeymen go to the old Y. It's where the carpenters and the plumbers and the electricians and the teachers, it's where we take our kids for nursery school. It's where we learn how to play all kinds of ball. It's where we swim. It's our Y. You know, because you walk in and the second the door opens, the effluvia of hundreds of years of sweat and chlorine fly up your nose. It's our Y. So it's the first night, and all the couples are there in the parking lot, and the women are all waving to each other, and the men are about as excited as dogs going to get spayed. Come on, honey. No, it'll be fine. Come on, come on. And we get into the Y, and they show us downstairs. And the downstairs gym really looks like a bomb shelter. I think it actually doubles as a bomb shelter. You know, it's like pow, hole in the ground, a few little windows. And it used to be, you could tell where the basketball court was. Now you just see a dim free throw line. Go ahead, say that quickly. Free throw line, on either side. And as we got down there, clearly the teachers weren't there yet because people were like packed in. And we're like, hello, everybody, hi. And such an idiot. There are my two friends. They're back to the wall in a DMZ of empty air between them and everyone else. Of course, Fred Astaire would have been better for them. Hans, Mark, hi guys! And I run over and I'm like so too cheery, it's unbelievable. I break the DMZ, I say, Martha, come, I want you to meet my friends. This is Mark, this is Hans, guys, it says, oh God, I am such an idiot to bring them here. And then the teachers arrive. Now, the female teacher looked exactly like you'd expect a female ballroom teacher to look like. Had the slit up to here, the hair on here, the high heels. She walks in, she goes, hi. I'm your girl teacher. This is your boy teacher. 6 feet, broad shoulders, dark, penetrating, handsome eyes, blue jeans, cowboy boots, a t-shirt with an anchor on one muscle, and on the other, the t-shirt rolled up over cigarettes, filterless. Every man breathes in, I am a dancer, and they follow him into the gym. Well, we array ourselves around the gymnasium, and we stand here, we stand right next to our friends, Hans and Mark, and no one stands to the right of them. Oh, I'm so sorry, I am such an idiot, I am such an idiot to bring. Well, the class gets started, and as in most relationships, the female does all the talking. Hi, everybody. Welcome to dance class. And she's like one. You remember those Chatty Cathy dolls where you pulled it and they said one line? Hi, my name's Chatty Cathy. That's how she communicated. Okay, boys on the left, girls on the right. We got a boy and boy here. I saw my friends, and they negotiated, and okay, Mark was the slighter of the two, so he would play the female role. Okay, now, boys are going to walk forward, girls backward. Hello, we have a boy and boy over here. All right, now, we're going to move across the floor. Make sure that the girl is well in hand before you start moving with your left foot. We have a boy and boy situation here. And then we got through most of class. In the last 15 minutes, Chatty Cathy says, okay, two circles. Girls on the inside, boys on the out. Now we're going to change partners. There is not a breath in the entire room. And my poor friend Mark actually starts to tremble. I'm such an idiot. I'm such an idiot. I mean, could I send them for a vacation in Hyannisport or something? Okay, so the first rotation was to my husband, and except for the fact that they were both execrable dancers, there was not a big problem there. And then the music stopped, and it's time for the next rotation, and Mark finds himself shaking as he stands before a huge electrician whose 5 o'clock shadow comes in at noon. He's got on a neatly checkered shirt that you're sure his wife made him change into before they came to class, and a belt that he buckles beneath the belly. Half of every pair of eyes is watching. And my poor friend is shaking all over. He's a social worker. He's one of the sweetest people you'd ever want to meet. We cook at the homeless mission together every fourth Thursday. This big electrician hears the music. We have 8 bars to come together. Every woman steps into her man's grip. He takes a look at my trembling friend.
What the hell?
And with that as a role model, every other man in that class danced with him. Well, at the end of the night, we were going out, and I said, "Hey, guys, you coming back next week?" Hans looked at Mark. It was his decision, and I guess trauma is quickly forgotten because Mark said, "Sure." And as we walked home, I said to my husband, "I am such an idiot that I don't have more faith in human beings."
Judith Black, recorded during the first evening of the 2013 Oklahoma City Storytelling Festival. Our story highlights conclude with an epic tale about a distant place and time. This ancient yarn is told by noted storyteller and musician Patrick Ball, who incorporates his love for antiquity, Ireland, and the Celtic harp into his entertaining performances. That's Patrick on the harp as he plays us into this final tale.
Thank you very much. Well, I'd like to tell you one more story, but it is hellish long. That woman's gone. And I want to dedicate this story to Christina Foss, because she was driving me around and she said that she has no Irish blood in her veins. But I know for a fact that she's at least 95% Irish in spirit. And she says, "I love the old stories." So I'd like to tell you, and her in particular, one of the oldest Irish stories I've ever known. But before I start, I have to tell you this. This story comes from a part of Ireland called Ulster, which is in the north. You might not know this, but Ireland is divided into 4 provinces, not counties, 4 provinces. In the north, there is Ulster. In the east, there is Leinster. In the south, there is Munster. And in the west, there is Connaught. But this story takes place in Ulster, and most of us know little about Ulster. So let me just tell you this. The people of Ulster in the old days had three great loves. They loved love and romance, like us. They loved war, because they were always fighting in the old stories, and they loved what? What do you think? They loved cows. They were great bovine connoisseurs. And this is the story about a man who loved cows, maybe a little bit too much. It's all about a great king in the north, in Ulster, by the name of Mongan, and this guy was content in all things but one. He, like perhaps all of us here, was a little short of cows. He simply hadn't as many as he thought was proper for a king, so he called his druids and he says, "Lads, what do you suppose I ought to do?" And so the druids consulted the stars and they read the ancient runes and they said, "Go you down now to the province of Leinster in the east and stock up." And so away went the great King Mongan of Ulster down to the province of Leinster. Now the king of Leinster at that time was a great hulking brute of a fella by the name of Brandov. He welcomed Mongan, and that night Mongan slept high in the palace. But at first light, he looked out of his lofty window, and what did he see on the sunny green lawn before him but a herd of... There were 50 cows in all, for he counted them, and each cow had a calf beside her. And each cow and each calf was pure white in color, and each cow and each calf had little red... Each cow and each calf had little red ears. Well, when Mongan saw the cows, he fell in love with them as he had never fallen in love with anything before. He walked among them and he whispered sweet words of bovine endearment into their little red ears. And then he noticed that someone was moving along beside him. "Are you in love with my cows?" says the king of Leinster. "Jeez, I am," says the king of Ulster. "Yeah, well, everybody is," says the king of Leinster. "I never saw anything like them," says the king of Ulster. "Yeah, nobody has," says the king of Leinster. "I never saw anything I'd rather have than these cows." "Yeah, well, these are the most beautiful cows in Ireland, and I'll tell you something else. Your wife, Duvlaka of the White Hand, she is the most beautiful woman in Ireland." "Yeah, true for you," says Mongan. "Well, isn't it a queer thing that I should have what you want with all your heart, and then you should have what I want with all my heart?" "Yeah, queer indeed," says Mongan, "but what is it you want?" He wasn't known for being quick on the uptake. He says, "I want your wife." "Are you telling me that you would trade this herd of 50 pure white cows with little red
ears
and their 50 calves for my wife, Duvlaka?" "I would," says the king of Leinster. "Done,"
says the King of Ulster, and the two wise kings shook hands in the bargain, and before another word could be said, Mongan set his men behind the cows, and he drove them north to Ulster. Well, when Duvlaka of the White Hand saw the cows, she fell in love with them as Mongan had done. For look, who could have avoided loving these cows? Such cows they were. But of course, the day of reckoning shortly arrived. For one morning, not long after, there was a great shouting of men and the rattle of armor and the trampling of horses' hooves. Mongan ran to the window. Who is that, my darling? That's the King of Leinster, come to complete his bargain. What bargain is that, she said. Never mind. But that night there was a grand feast, and all throughout the feast, Brandulf stared at Duvlaka with eyes as big as plates, so fevered and enlarged and inflamed they were, just by the look of her, for I'm telling you something now, she was a stunner right enough.
There's something wrong with the King of Leinster, says Duvlaka.
I don't care if there is, says Mongan.
You must ask him what he wants.
I don't want to know.
You must ask him. It's Celtic hospitality.
Do you want anything?
I want your wife! Well, look, I want her too, says Mongan.
You made a bargain, my cows and their 50 calves, for your Duvlaka, and the man that makes a bargain keeps the bargain.
Duvlaka looked at Mongan.
Oh, jeez, you didn't.
I did, says he. Then you must keep your bargain, for honor is longer than this life. Do you say that, my darling?
I do, she says.
Then let the King of Leinster take her!
And so Duvlaka of the White Hand, the great jewel of the province of Ulster, went away to the province of Leinster with that king of that country. But as you all know from your reading, it was only after she had gone that Mongan realized that, by God, he loved her better than he loved his honor, better than he loved his life, better even than he loved his... Now I'm thinking there might be one, two, three, maybe all of you here who can remember feeling sometime in the course of your life towards somebody the way Mongan felt towards Duvlaka. But he remembered that when she was with him, the kingdoms of this earth did not weigh with him beside the string of her shoe. Do you remember that? He remembered that when she was with him, he would not look at a sunset if he could see her. Do you remember that? He remembered that when she was with him, he would not listen to a harp if he could hear her speak. And these memories of her scalded his heart, and he fell ill, and he began to wither and waste away.
At last,
his nobles came to his bedside. They said, look, we're going to go down to Leinster, right? We're going to kill that freaking king for you. We're going to get your wife back. What do you say?
And Mong says, no. For the wife that I lost through my own folly, I'm going to get back through my own craft.
Because he was, like almost all the great kings of the ancient times, a bit of a wizard himself. And so he called his servant and he says, look, man, you know that I can't get Dovlaka back unless the king of Leinster asks me to take her back. For a bargain is a bargain.
The servant says, yeah, I know that, but that'll happen when cows fly, won't it?
He says, go. Go you now to the fairy place.
Go to the gentle place.
Bring me the baskets that I left there, with a sod from Ireland in one and the sod from Scotland in the other.
Yeah, I'll do that, said the servant. But would you tell me why?
The king of Leinster will be asking his wizards what I'm doing. And this is what I'll be doing. I'm going to get on your back with a foot in each of those baskets. And when the king of Leinster asks his wizards where I am, they'll tell him, I got one leg in Ireland and one leg in Scotland. And we're going to go into Leinster that way. It was a long journey. But as you're learning tonight, if you keep on driving a pig or a story, it'll get at last where you want it to go. So there they stood before the walls of the castle. Well, how are we going to get into that place, said the servant. And well, he might ask, because there were hatchet men on guard in the gateway and spearmen on guard around the wallway. And worst of all, there were men standing on the roof next to huge black cauldrons waiting to pour hot porridge down onto anybody that needed it. But Mongan was not a king for nothing. He wasn't daunted. He says, if we can't get in by hook, we're going to get in by...
Them are both good ways, said the servant.
But just then, the hag of the mill,
came down the road towards him.
Now the hag of the mill
was a long, thin, bony pole of a hag with odd feet. She was
your standard hag.
She was so tall, you thought you'd never see the end of her, and so thin you thought, well, geez, maybe you didn't see her at all. She had long, scraggly red hair that stuck up and poked out and hung down about her head in bushes and spikes and tangles. But for all that, she had a charming smile and a lovely personality.
Tell me there, hag, says Mongan, tell me now. If you could have your wish, what would you wish for?
Well, let me think.
Would you like to be a lovely young girl?
I'd rather be that than a skinned eel.
Would you like to marry me or the King of Leinster?
I'll marry either of you, or both of you, or whichever of you came first.
Very well, says Mongan. And with that, he touched her on the shoulder. And instantly, all dilapidation and all wryness and all age and all pain went from her. She became so beautiful. You could hardly look at her, and so young. She was not a day over 17 years of age. He says, you are the hag of the mill no longer. You are now Yvel of the Shining Cheeks, daughter of the King of Munster. And then he changed himself into the son of the king of Connaught, who had just married Ivel, and they went into the castle that way. Now, as luck would have it, it was the very night of the marriage feast between Brandov and Dovlaka, and Mongan and the hag sat right opposite. And all throughout the feast, Mongan put more and more magic and more glamour into the hag, so that her eyes gleamed and her cheeks shone, and she was utterly bewitching to the eye. And as Bram had looked at her, she seemed to get more and more lovely and more desirable, until at last there was not one bone in his body as big as an inch that wasn't filled with love and longing for that girl. At last he could stand it no longer and leans over and he says, "I'll tell you something. It's a far better thing to be the wife of a king like me than to be the wife of a prince like that fellow there. What do you say?" And this beautiful, exquisitely beautiful woman says, "That's the wisest thing I ever heard, big boy." Mongan quickly touched her on the shoulder. "That's the wisest thing anybody has ever said to me. Well, I'll tell you something else. If I don't get my hands on you quick, I'm going to burst of love." And the hag says, "Oh, you're beautiful. Beautiful way with words. Has won my heart. Oh, take me." Brandov leaped out of his chair. He says to Mongan, "Do you see that woman there? That is Dovlaka of the White Hand, who was just going to marry her. But if you'll make the exchange, you can have Dovlaka, and I'll take that little cupcake there. What do you say?" And Mongan says, "Are you asking me? Are you asking me to take Dovlaka?" "I am, and you must not refuse a lord." "Very well," says Mongan. "I shall take Dovlaka of the White Hand." Then there was great feasting and merriment and maybe a little bit of drinking too. Until at last everyone was stretched out paralytic on the floor, having their faces cleaned in the Celtic way by the... You've been there, ma'am. When Mongan rose up and he ran to the stables and he fetched two of the swiftest horses, and then he and Dovlaka on the one and the servant on the other, whew, raced north, going to Ulster like the wind. Meanwhile, back in Leinster, Brandov woke to find himself in his own bed. He rolled over to once again embrace his lovely new bride. And he goes, "Aren't you the hag of the mill?" "I am. I am. And aren't you a frisky lover?" Brandov fainted dead away. Meanwhile, back in Ulster, Mongan, a much wiser man, and his beloved Dovlaka had a grand feast. They invited all their friends and all their cows with a little red. And that feast lasted for 7 days and seven nights. And wasn't the seventh day better than the first? And wasn't I there playing the harp for him? And didn't I get a present of a pair of paper boots and stockings of stirabout that I wore through to the soles of my feet in coming here to tell you this tale?
That's Patrick Ball, who, along with Judith Black and Barbara McBride-Smith, shared their tales during the inaugural evening of the 2013 Oklahoma City Storytelling Festival. The stories you heard on this special highlights broadcast were recorded live at the Oklahoma History Center. My thanks to Christina Foss and the Arts Council of Oklahoma City, and to the tellers mentioned who allowed us to record for this broadcast. For more on the annual Oklahoma City Storytelling Festival and other Arts Council of Oklahoma City programs, visit artscouncilokc.com. I'm Jim Johnson with a big thank you for listening, and perhaps even a bit of encouragement to you to share your stories. Because as the late poet Maya Angelou once said, quote, "There is no agony like bearing an untold story inside of you."
Thank you very much.